were saying earlier that you compare the Iranian Revolution, the significance, with the revolution in China in 49. Now, when you were thinking about these things about that in 78, what were your apprehensions about the impact of the revolution?
I didn't think of that kind of parallel because I did not think of the forces at play as those of unconquerable revolution. Of unavoidable revolution, and one thought of the instruments of authority available to the Shah as much greater than in China, and that the military instruments that Mao Zedong had were simply not available to Khomeini. It was, after all, a military victory of the communists in China over Chiang Kai-shek. There were no military forces. So this was a question of dealing with public sentiments for which the Shah had become increasingly ill-equipped, as it were, to deal effectively. My apprehensions were first of enhanced and greater instability in the oil markets, which was my nominal area of responsibility, but I was much more concerned about the geopolitical position of the United States in the region. With the Shah, for all the reasons that we had laid out, going back to the early 1970s, was the central figure, the linchpin of the American position in the region, and that we could not allow him fall without destroying, as it were, our position in the region, our image in the region, and the damage to that amongst the Arabs, Saudis, and others. And moreover, that I suspected at the time that the successor arrangement in Iran was going to be of a fragmented, divided authority. I did not imagine at the time, I did not imagine even well into 1979 when I was testifying on these matters before the Senate. I did not imagine that the Khomeini would be able to establish and retain the absolute control over the outlying parts of the country, and that there was going to be a free field for the Soviets to play in, either by snipping off pieces, possibly snipping off pieces of the country, but by kind of general destruction. Those were my apprehensions at the time, that we would lose a major asset, that the collapse of the Cento, in which the Shah was critical, meant that this belt, that we had, security belt that we had established and supported with greater or lesser enthusiasm since the 1950s, that security belt would be hopelessly shattered, and that belt, the northern tier, had been established in a way to prevent southward movement of the Soviets toward the Indian Ocean. I feared that all of that might take place. Indeed, many of these fears were expressed when I left the Department of Energy in my farewell remarks, but they had been expressed 7 months earlier, as I recall it, in a speech that I gave in London to the pilgrims on the occasion, more or less, of the Thanksgiving anniversary. Pilgrims in London do celebrate Thanksgiving. I've given a speech in which I talked of the geopolitical situation in Iraq, in the Middle East, in the light of the threats to the Shah's continuation in office. And I held out some dire predictions with regard to the consequences of the fall, though I was not as publicly pessimistic about his chances for survival in those reality matters.
Well, you mentioned earlier about Fritz Kramer's warning that the Shah was in mortal danger. That was in the spring of 78.
March of 78, if I recall.
Except for that, it seems like the revolution took most intelligence officials, policymakers, by great surprise. Why do you think?
Be very careful about that. Policymakers by surprise, yeah. More than intelligence officials,
yeah.
Because from the early fall, I would get Burgos to bring over people from the CIA to brief me, and it was plain that down there at the bottom that they took a view much less sanguine than was being expressed officially by the intelligence agencies. I think that it was simply a failure of intelligence. Why do I say that? I think it was a failure of intelligence, not because of the usual things that it's ascribed to, that the Shah wouldn't let us speak to dissident groups within the country that we had agreed as a consequence of being in country and having those facilities up on the north border, not to fiddle around with dissidents, but to take the official path. That's not what I'm referring to, because that indeed may have been a condition of our being in country. The fact of the matter was that most intelligence agencies around the world, including the most significantly the Israeli intelligence, had concluded that the Shah was on the skids by the middle of 1978. And the British took a more pessimistic view, a far more pessimistic view than we did, and that we were simply not disregarding or not inquiring as to the attitude of our sister intelligence agencies, some of which were better qualified to make those judgments than we were. We were not sufficiently modest to recognize that, perhaps. But, you know, the Israelis depended upon the Shah for their oil. And they took an even greater interest in the well-being of the Shah than we did. But we did not take into account, I doubt that we really absorbed and attempted to absorb the attitudes of other intelligence agencies allied to us with an equal interest in the country. And therefore, I think that the intelligence failure was simply that Fritz Kramer, as many may know, was given to, a kind of traumatic and stark pessimism. And the time that Fritz sent that letter to me with a number of cables attached, I thought that the Shah was indeed in considerable trouble. But the letter said, "Sir, the Shah is in mortal peril." Mortal peril struck me as a Kramerian overstatement. But that the indulgent attitude that was taken by American intelligence up until the time of the Abadan fire, indeed beyond the Abadan fire, was wholly unwarranted. Even though one might not agree with Kramer's immediate and intuitive judgments of this sort, intelligence communities don't make those kinds, or at least our intelligence community does not make an intuitive judgment. They look for hard evidence, as they put it. Intuitive people like Kramer and those agencies that have fewer resources and have to depend upon shreds of information and plus intuition are in a position to make those judgments, and those intuitions happened in that case to have been far sounder than any of the hard take that we were getting.
Well, earlier you said that, there were basically two of the polarity of policy between what you suggested and the State Department. There was a conflict in the State Department position and your position.
Yeah, there was a basic, basic difference in approach.
Yeah.
I have raised questions about the appropriateness of the approach of Brzezinski and myself. Even more so because Brzezinski went on in January and February when I thought it becomes quite irrelevant. The reason that I stressed the inappropriateness in retrospect was that none of us had knowledge of that indeed, to borrow Kramer's phrase, that the Shah was in mortal peril from cancer, and that therefore might be physically and psychologically in no position to carry off the actions that the history imposed upon him under those circumstances.
But given those alternatives, you suggest that the Carter did not make a choice.
Oh, yeah.
Why did you give a sense of why that was the case? Why you did not decide on a policy, or get any kind of a hint from the advisor as to what was what the cost of things?
Curtis' propensity was to let things sort themselves out. So Carter tended to believe in reconciliation, if I can put it that way. Negotiations, you put Sadat and Begin into the same room, and they hammer out the reconciliation of sorts. You put energy and environment in the same room, and they hammer out the reconciliation. He was a believer in consensus. It's the way, in part, that he succeeded as governor of Georgia, or he felt he succeeded. And he applied these techniques on the international scene to groups of nations to which they were inapplicable. He thought that people could hammer out their differences and that no differences were so irreconcilable. And therefore, the thing to do was to let people mill around and that sooner or later they would bridge their differences. It happened to be a deeply felt faith with Carter. I think that it comes sort of out of his Sunday school tradition. People of different views through extensive discussion would ultimately come to a measure of agreement. That was part of it. More on that point, and parallel to it, is Jimmy Carter had the deficiency, in my judgment, in understanding that he did not understand when there was a hopeless logical contradiction. Carter was a detail man. He never did quite get an overview. And if he had more of a capacity for overview, he would say, what I'm hearing from these fellows, and what I'm hearing from these fellows, simply are irreconcilable, and I'm going to have to decide. He didn't believe in logical irreconcilability. So I think that that's it. Also, as I mentioned, Carter was himself preoccupied with the normalization of China. Throughout this period, the process of the SALT II negotiations was far more important to the United States government. He was paying less attention to it. As I say, when I visited him early in January, just prior to the visit to Guadeloupe, it was plain that Guadeloupe was much more on his mind than was the development. He gave me a little speech on what was going to happen down in Guadeloupe at the outset of our discussion. Plainly much more on his mind than what was happening in Iran. So he may not have felt it necessary to focus on, as well as that Carter had great difficulty in saying these positions are really irreconcilable. It was true inside the country, and he did not understand, in my judgment at least, that there were irreconcilable positions within the country, and that they could not be straddled by a Barzagar, or, for that matter, by a council of elders, a council of notables, that either the throne was going to be sustained by the army, or Khomeini was going to take over, and that you didn't have other alternatives.
I don't think I have any more comments unless you have some concluding remarks you want to make.
I don't know that I have.
No.
I don't know that I have any concluding remarks. It may well be true, though I did not think of it at the time and still have doubts about it, that this was a hurricane of revolutionary force that was not going to be suppressed by any measures. That is not my reading in general of lesser states that have been leaned upon by great powers, particularly Iran. While it is less plausible that the Shah had the fortitude to pull these things off, given his illness, and it is less plausible since you see the outcome in Iran, which you cannot foresee in advance. Everything in retrospect looks inevitable. The British historian Maybert said, something to the effect that I can't recall his exact phrase, but that in looking back, we see so many things that are inevitable that as we look to the actual development at the time, seem to the parties quite avoidable. And I think that should govern our view of these kinds of developments. And I'm sure you cited a Jaruzelski in Poland, but the Soviet thumb on Poland is clearly much greater than the American thumb on Iran at any time, including 1953. So one should not think of the outcome as inevitable or foreordained. If you want to, I can get that phrase from me. In retrospect, I think that the fact that the martial law that was declared on November the 6th was so visible a failure should have told us that the Shah didn't have what was needed. He didn't have the will or the insight to control the situation. And that is the consequence of that failure, that the thing was pretty hopeless. And that the United States indeed should have moved, if you could imagine a compromised position between what Brzezinski was saying and what the state people in Paul were saying. But we should have moved early. We should have obtained the knowledge about the Shah's cancer. We should have moved early to replace the Shah with his son, that he could no longer hold. that the replacement of the Shah might have deflected the anger of some of the groups that had traditionally supported the monarchy or had good reason to support the monarchy. I refer particularly to the middle class and to the bazaar, and that there might have been a wave of enthusiasm for the replacement, particularly if you had taken the ringleaders away just prior to that and had limited Khomeini's communications with the country, but that the Shah himself couldn't pull it off any longer. That we probably should have recognized that late November, early December, as the results of martial law, partly through the Shah's era of choice, and partly through the Shah's ambivalence about martial law, that the Shah didn't have it, that indeed that he had to be replaced, not by his council of elders stuff, council of nobles, although that might have been a useful answer. One would have had to make the new young Shah central to the hopes, and to have him give some speeches that would have stirred hope for the regime, and that might have calmed the streets. In retrospect, I think that was the only hope to head it off. As to my own role, I regret that I was sufficiently so preoccupied with other matters that I was unable seriously to get engaged until it was almost too late, if not too late. It was plain that the Shah was getting into increasing trouble in the summer. By the summer, he was in trouble in the fall. I followed the intelligence with some interest, but I never got involved seriously. The Shah would have benefited from some very clear guidance from the United States early on. He always felt that the United States was ambivalent. Indeed, the United States was ambivalent. He was right. That in the spring, I think that the kinds of gestures that were made in December, January of 78-9, attempts to transform the regime, to make it more open, to restore the Constitution of 1906 and so forth. In the spring, well before you had all of the events that followed from Abadan, that reconciliation rather than the Iron Fist might have worked. By the fall, it was too late because the public had forbidden.
But even if the Shah conceded that, he didn't even announce that sick, but he conceded the feeding power. Would that have been something that he'd been able to do? Would the Shah have been able to, even if he had been healthy, was he the kind of a person who had ceded power under those circumstances?
Very, very doubtful. He would have had been pressed very hard by the Americans. But you see, the Shah, who could be so opinionated and arrogant when there was no trouble, was a very indecisive man in the face of adversity. He had to be carried through in 1953 by the Americans. And throughout 1978, he was looking for guidance. And I think that it is at least plausible that if he had taken a very firm line, such as, Your Majesty, you've got two choices. Spring. Restore the Constitution, call the monarchs, make yourself, in effect, the leader of the establishment of a limited monarchy, or alternatively, you would then have to sooner or later. crack down, and that they, that he cannot pussyfoot. So that he might well have taken my advice. Great Marxists like Plekhanov, Marxist historians like Plekhanov tells us that it's social events rather than individuals that make history. That social events form the individuals. And one can argue on behalf of Plekhanov's views of that subject that both the United States and Iran were in that crisis, played by indecision and by leaders decisively that wanted it both ways. And more decisively,
thank you very much for your time. Sorry about those problems.